We continue our conversation with Dr. Yogi Hinlan on how to change our evil ways and to save ourselves from ourselves. Welcome to Deep Transformation, Self, Society, Spirit, life-enhancing, paradigm-rattling conversations with cutting-edge thinkers, contemplatives, and activists, with Dr. Roger Walsh and John Dupuy. Join us in the evolutionary fast lane as we take a deep dive into transformational practice, peak experience, profound understanding, powerful contribution. So how do we recreate that sense of connection with one another, with nature, with community? And I think I'm thinking of my own answers. We're living also in a psychedelic age. Now it's all come back online, and some of your writings, you've talked about your concern about it being taken over by capitalism and desire to control and make money instead of kind of the sacred basic idea. And I'm not sure you can control psychedelics, even though you might like to. I think it's going to be doing its work, maybe unspoken, unnoted, but people are going to be changing and opening up to experiencing reality in a more sacred, connected way.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that work on decolonizing the psychedelic renaissance up, John, because I think that it's a very important, for me, a sacred duty to protect these sacraments and the cultures and traditions that surround them and through which they have been pressure tested for thousands of years from the cannibalization, the metabolism of industrial society, which is to make psychedelics, you know, psilocybin, for instance, into the next SSRIs. Right? SSRIs failed us. We saw that umbrella study from 2022 showing that their efficacy is not what previously had been reported, which had been an open secret since the 70s. But still, the drug manufacturers had promulgated them, and you know, many people were overprescribed them to great harm in many cases. And they're trying to do the same thing with psychedelics. And actually, they want to engineer the trip out of the curative therapeutic experience. There's this quite inaccurate, but very loud hypothesis of psychoplastogens, right? That you could engineer the trip out of a psychedelic experience so that it could be administered in a 1 hour therapy session and that it would do the sort of biochemical work without having the psychological or emotional correlates, which I think is abuse of the patients, right? If you have a change happening to you and you have nothing to map that onto, no narrative, no myth, no experience, then could that be more traumatizing, or could that create psychotic robots out of us, you know, zombies? So while I hear your faith that these sacraments do have the potential to work their effects no matter what, just as if you take a plant, even in extract form, there may be part of that plant that still can do its other sort of entourage effect in helping, that I find from my background in biology, and especially with plants, plant studies, is that it would not be responsible for us to ask the plants and other life forms to do all the work for themselves in the face of this onslaught, that it's not an honorable fight, as it were. And that indeed, you know, part of protecting psychedelics also from charlatans, right? People who are offering you a ayahuasca ceremony because their ego is involved or because they want to make money off of it is extremely important, because once bitten, twice shy, people have a bad experience that can cause psychosis. I, for that reason, even though I have benefited greatly from the experiences and ceremonies that I've had with well-trained facilitators and indigenous guides, that I do not recommend, for example, people willy-nilly to take psychedelics, because I think that if you're smoking and drinking and eating ultra-processed foods, the chances of that experience having long-term benefits are much less than if you are fasting, praying, set up an altar, are drastically changing your life because you have a prayer that you're very clear about that is at the center of your life at that moment, and that the psychedelic merely is there to help support that already pre existing process. There's many studies of megalomania and narcissism that can occur when people who are not in a humble, prayerful mindset go to these to seek more power. Right.
Right.
And so
black magic, we might say.
Sure. And so I think that part of being a responsible human being means creating a community that ensures low abuse liability, not just for psychedelics, but for any experience, for work, for relationships. We want to lower the abuse liability, and there's many good ways to do that. And community is probably the best way. How many school shootings would we have if we had fewer police, more social workers, and people checking in with each other, every single human being on our planet checking in with each other on a regular basis? You would be able to suss out who is lonely, who is depressed, who isn't getting the social recognition that they need. It's like food and water to us. We must get to the point where we understand as a society that being seen as being a full member of our community, to be as a contributing member to our human society and to contributing, is a human need as great as food and water. And once we get there, once we check in with each other, I think a lot of our so-called problems will fall away as epiphenomena, as sort of side effects or symptoms of these underlying malaise of not feeling the connection to ourselves, others, and the environment.
Wow, Yogi, there's so much in what you said. I want to make sure that I want to try and distill a little of it, just point to some of it and make sure that some of your key points are emphasized. First off, you were just talking about the importance of community and belonging, and may help us to remember that Abraham Maslow's so famous idea of the hierarchy of needs, that belonging is a fundamental base need that all of us have. And unless that's satisfied, there's going to be pathology. So that you also spoke about the importance of different motives, and that so much that there are motives beyond our usual, the usual ones we acknowledge in this culture, what Maslow called meta-motives, self-actualization, self-transcendence, as he put it at the peak. And I would add beyond that, I think there are at least three motives beyond what Maslow recognized. One is selfless service that comes as a natural expression once one is some self-transcendence. And at a certain point, there comes a what I call transpersonal spontaneity, a trust in one's being and a trust that allows one to be spontaneous and responsive to situations without the kind of obsessive pre-planning and manipulation and ego drives, etc. So just to acknowledge those possibilities. Also want to go back to what you said about, because again, there was so much there about the skillful use of psychedelics. And because as you and John have pointed out, there's a renaissance, a psychedelic renaissance. And some of us, myself included, have worked quite hard over a number of years to legitimize the skillful use of these substances in our society. And I'm now kind of swinging the other extreme of just being very worried about the lack of skill with which they're being used in many cases, lack of skills, which you just pointed to. And a couple of things that come to mind. One is you emphasized how important any psychedelic experience it is to have adequately prepared oneself and humbled oneself and purified, essentially. And I'm reminded of that saying of Lachance, I think it was, who said, Laplace, who said, chance favors the prepared mind, which is very true. And then what the early psychedelic researchers themselves said some years ago, I did a little research study looking at people who were acknowledged spiritual teachers, meditation teachers primarily, and had also had very profound experiences waking up with psychedelics. So this was a rare group who had deep awakening experiences, both from contemplation and from psychedelics. And I was very curious to ask them, well, what was their take on psychedelics? I was fascinated to find a remarkable unanimity among them which was that these curious chemicals can be very valuable as long as they're used skillfully and as long as they're used as part of a larger spiritual practice. By themselves, they don't constitute a path of themselves, though they can be useful experiences. But their real value comes when placed in the context and facilitated and catalyzed and complemented by a spiritual practice. And finally, the one other point you mentioned I want to emphasize, because you pointed out this horrifying idea, which I hadn't heard of, that the companies and I imagine insurance down the line would like to have a psychedelic which would just change your chemistry without having to go through all the messy experiences. And one of the dangers that Ram Dass mentioned about psychedelics was the trap of thinking that it's the drug doing it, instead of acknowledging that so much depends on the person, us, and the way we approach the experience and hold it and work with it and call on assistance and metabolize it, etc. So there's just so much in what you said, Yogi. I just wanted to name several of the key points to make sure they were emphasized for people.
Thanks so much for deepening those points, Roger. To also connect that to what John was saying, you know, I do believe to a certain extent that there is this future holding us. It's not a specific future. It's not guaranteed. But there are so many possibilities that do pull us towards, I think it's Arundhati Roy who says, you know, on a clear day, I can hear it breathing, like the future that all our hearts know is possible. And that psychedelics have become, unfortunately, sort of just the therapy du jour for both spiritual seekers in many sense, and also now the pharmaceutical industrial complex and the medical industrial complex and the healthcare industrial complex, because they do have, you know, efficacy in many cases. But nothing is for everyone, right? No treatment is for all patients. And in an age of personalized medicine and precision medicine, we still sometimes think like, oh, we should just put X, Y, or Z in the water. And every time I hear that, a red flag goes up in my mind, or that there's one path for everyone. We know from the history of the world's religions that there is no one path for everyone, but there are many virtuous paths that, if followed assiduously with support in a sangha, a kula, a spiritual community, can bring one to a more evolved, more mature place in one's life and relation with all else than without that path. So one of my favorite stories in Buddhism is looking for water. And I think in my own lifetime, I've seen so many breath work, psychedelics, yoga, various forms of meditation, various sort of spiritual paths being presented as the next big thing, the thing that's going to do the work for you, like you said, Roger. And always we're looking for something external to validate an internal experience, to do the work for us. And I think that this is an especially American disease of shopping for spiritualities and like the next big trend in sort of self-improvement and progress. And the Zen people say there is no improvement. Like it's a negative process all the way down. And I like this because I think it's good medicine for our current obsession with buying, with consuming new things, the novelty, the obsession with novelty that we have, as if new technologies are going to save us. And I see all of these sort of tendencies to be very interrelated. And so this Buddhist parable says, if you're looking for water, you take your shovel and you start digging a few meters. And if you want to hit water, you might say, over there actually looks better. I want to go dig over there. So you go over there, dig a few meters, and then something else catches your eye and say, actually, I think maybe under that tree. So you keep on digging a few meters here and there, but you never hit water. You spend your whole life digging. And the point is not just the digging. The point is to hit water. And that happens from doing the inner work, which nobody can do for you, which no psychedelic can do for you, no guru can do for you, no therapist or therapy can do for you. And that doesn't mean that it happens alone or in isolation, right? So that's the other side of it. It's not pull yourself up by the bootstraps. It's cultivate an ecology, internal and external, that is supportive for feeling the things that we are scared of feeling, thinking the things that we're scared of thinking, connecting to the people that we're apprehensive or don't feel that we deserve to connect with. All of that de-armoring of that very vulnerable, very sensitive work is usually, but not always, slow going. It's not a get rich quick scheme. It's not a silver bullet. It's not taking psilocybin in a medicalized context where you think that that's going to be the cure all. Every practice, every, you know, serious practitioner, whether it's with psychedelics or otherwise, knows that if you want to change your life and if you want to change the world, it's not an event that's circumscribed by everyday activity. No, it's this ongoing interdimensional fractal interpenetrating project where you're going to be faced with conflict and tension and resistance on a regular basis. And it's how do we deal with and interface with those feelings that come up, those thoughts that come up, those reactions, those barriers. And then how do we choose differently? How do we create more sovereignty, more freedom, more space, more connection, more solidarity in the process? And I think that that's something that's so individual. Like everyone's path is very different in that respect and regard, but everybody knows what some of the steps on that process are. And the question is, am I willing to embark on that even if all the things I'm afraid, I'm scared, I feel intense emotions, or I feel I don't deserve it, things like that. And I know we're speaking at quite an abstract level, and that's something that I often want to like bring down to earth, right? And all of our systems, our food systems, our pharmaceutical systems, our agricultural systems, all right now are based on efficiency of the wrong kind, trying to extract as much of a very narrow thing as possible at the expense of everything else. And part of becoming more integrated, I believe, has to do with learning how our actions affect others, human and more than human, in ways that we weren't able to imagine before. And not to beat ourselves up or self-punish, call ourselves out or cancel ourselves as a result, but instead be curious, you know, have that childlike wonder of, oh, wow, I wasn't even aware of that. What steps can I get? What support can I rally in order to make some transitions, some transformations in my life?
I had a comment on that, then a couple of questions. As you said, that psychedelics aren't for everyone, but for us that are chosen to do that, maybe the recognition that we're not simply doing it for ourselves, but for all our relations, as the Lakota say, Metaquias, and that, you know, we're just a small part of a much bigger picture. And perhaps if enough of us do it in the right way, then that energy and that effect will get out into the world and create a better context, a holier context, a more sacramental context to those who come after us and use these things. We'll learn from our mistakes and how we did it wrong, and learn how to hold a person in that way and how to help young people progress into being human beings for all their relations and what that means, all their relations. And I wanted to, Heidi always asks me that we don't forget this question. And I have the two questions is, obviously you're a very learned man, and you're not just smart, you're wise, and you have a soul force that comes through in your communication that I certainly been getting today. So what is your practice? Part one of the quest, and part two, how did you get here? It's quite a road you've been on. And if you just like to talk a little bit about that, I would find it very interesting. And I think our community of listeners would feel the same.
Sure. I'd love to, John. Just a brief aside, I absolutely do believe that with psychedelics, like the more people can hold in reverence, you know, our relationship to all of our relations in that practice and honor our elders and those who came before us on these paths and traditions. And, you know, if we're going to form new paths and traditions, to do so in a community that can really check us if we need checking, right? And people who have some wisdom, you know, also obtains for Christianity, Judaism, Islam, all other religions as well. Because I was reading Neil Gaiman's American Gods, right? In that book, Neil Gaiman talks about, you know, Jesus, who is the biggest God in the Americas, but, you know, feels very abandoned because he feels that many of his followers haven't really fully embraced his teachings and are misusing his teachings. So I think that, you know, coming back to the humility, the discipline, all the virtues, which all of these religions have at their core, right? Some people call it perennial philosophy. When we can practice whatever our path is, whatever well we're digging, if we can dig that well with patience, purpose, and flow, then we are doing good work for our brethren, not just in our in-group, you know, in our tribe, but for all of existence everywhere, the seen and the unseen. So my practices at the moment, I would say I first must confess that I have a hard time having a daily regular practice of anything. Discipline is something, you know, my father used to always chide me for not being disciplined enough. And I think that is something that in the last years I've been working to cultivate more of because I reacted so strongly against that. And so my practices have a lot more to do with combining movement on a daily basis, whether that's yoga or Tai Chi or swimming or riding my bicycle, or even when I'm sitting in a chair doing Kegel exercises, right? Even if I'm here feeling the proprioception of my body, feeling my feet on the floor, feeling my ankles and my knees and my hips and my pelvic bowl. I got to work with Philip Shepherd a little bit, who wrote this book, Radical Wholeness. And he teaches us, if we want to get out of our head and into our heart, we need to go all the way to the pelvic floor and bring our awareness there to our pelvic bowl, because then that's the other sort of pull between the head and the pelvic bowl allows the heart to rest in the center. And that's how we get to the heart. So my Vipassana practice, which my first Vipassana retreat was when I was maybe 22, it ended 1 week before I went to my first Burning Man, just to give some context. And
good preparation.
2002. I actually, at Burning Man that year, Livy, I was in a teepee. Every morning and every evening, I would meditate for 1 hour, even with like 1,000 different sound systems, putting 1,000 different types of music out and just having it sound like all this mush and just feeling the chaos of what was going there and feeling my own aversion to that and feeling okay with it eventually through equanimity. And so it was an amazing juxtaposition, those two events, but I've since pursued Vipassana. And I find that it's one of the tripods of my spiritual path. I would say Vipassana, Buddhist meditation, Taoism, and the traditions of indigenous practices and ceremonies that I've been, you know, honored enough to participate in form sort of the tripod of my spiritual path, which informs my physical process and vice versa. I believe that everything is cross-training. So trying to be aware even of, not always, but at moments, the sound of my voice, is it sonorous? Is it a little bit squeezed? And trying to have a little bit of awareness of my own self-censorship in various ways, because I am an academic after all. And there are lots of, you know, as Roger knows well, there are a lot of forces that would prefer you to be system compliant, even if that comes at the expense, depth of conveying certain teaching, certain ways of eliciting self-thought, like the Socratic method, for example, which at its core is a negative practice. It's telling people the answer. And in a university setting, not telling people the answer can be very annoying especially when just tell me what the answer is so I can regurgitate it back to you and get a good grade. And I do not fault the student. They are trying to jump through hoops in a system that has told them that that's the way to succeed. And I get it because I was one of those students, you know, at a certain point. So yeah, my practices are greatly informed by the company I keep. You all know you are the composite of your best friends, right? Of those whose ideas that you appreciate, those who you're able to have a long hug with and release all that oxytocin with. Whenever I can, I try to go for those long hugs to keep my hormones as balanced as possible. Because even having a family myself, life for me is sometimes lonely. I think a lot of people who are challenging dominant narratives in our culture feel lonely, even if they're surrounded by other people who are also doing the same. So I happen to be an acro yoga teacher. So that's a combination of acrobatics, yoga, and Thai massage. And while I don't get to teach that much these days, anytime I get to play with somebody to physically engage in some Tai Chi or something like that, it allows me to remember play. And play and self-reflection, or as Merleau Ponty called it, surreflexion, are the two ways that I've found that help ungroove us from dysfunctional habit patterns. Just as little puppies play or monks meditate, these different ways of being, of reflecting on reflecting, which isn't just intellectual, and playing, which has no purpose, but is taken seriously, right? Serious play are, for me, the moments in which whatever accumulated head burden I have, you know, being too much in my head, worries about the future or regrets about the past, any of those things, they melt away. They melt away and I can shift my state and come back to the present through physical play. Usually I'm also a musician. So I play the handpans. I play a drum set and, you know, getting sweaty, doing some polyrhythms and odd time signatures on my drum set engages my mind enough, like, you know, Balinese gamelan. It has enough of those very fast, high frequencies. And then it has the low boom that actually direct my somatic body that, again, these are equilibrating practices. So I try to have enough of that to be happy. And it's not always achievable, but with the help of friends and families and, you know, making choices to take the responsibility for being different, for being weird or being unconventional, and getting a little bit less scared of that day by day, I find that my life is more rich in every way.
Beautiful. Yeah. And as you've laid out the many facets of your practice, I've had the sense of looking at it all and thinking, oh, yes, you're really, as your name implies, a karma yogi, someone who takes their work and activity and family and everything in their life as their path. Beautiful. And also the implication, which you didn't put a lot of attention on, but clearly there's the implication that your inner life and your practices are in the service of not your own well-being, to be sure, but also to enable you to become a more effective instrument of service. And that's beautiful. In some ways, that feels like the very rhythm of karma yoga and of what's called for in our contemporary times. Because if you look at the great challenges we're facing, all of them now, for the first time in history, reflect a human created, which means that some level our global problems are creations of our own individual and collective psychological dysfunctions and immaturities and neuroses, etc. And that what we call our global problems are actually global symptoms. They're symptoms of our individual and collective psychological, spiritual dis-ease. And which means that if we're really to address them, we're going to have to work on both the symptoms themselves, plus the inner roots within us, between us, from which they spring. And that feels like the kind of work you're doing and enables you to go into yourself in order to go more effectively out into the world, and how able to go out into the world in order to go deeper into yourself and to keep that beautiful rhythm going. And having given us this beautiful account of your practice, and I know you want to take and are taking this out into the world, what are the next projects that are calling you as you look forward from this deep, this place of deep inner work and reflection? What is calling you for your next work in the world?
Thank you for that beautiful reflection and the way that you're able to sort of fill in some of the in-between lines of what I'm feeling and thinking and trying to say. Yeah, I would say personally, and I'll start with this, I've always been very clear on purpose. So I see, you know, to be of great service, one must have a certain amount of fierceness and a certain amount of compassion. And for me, I've always been great at being the keisaku stick, right, of in zazen, like on the shoulder, or the sword cutting through the Gorgon knot. That's always been one of my strengths. But compassion has been more difficult. And I've been realizing as I've been sort of moving into greater and greater roles and contributing to society that how fragile we all are, how much misunderstanding, how much miscommunication is just waiting on the other side of these paper thin doors. And for me, that's meant that I really have had to learn more about and step up my compassion game. I've needed to learn how to not make people feel uncomfortable or called out, or feel like if they don't agree with me that I don't like them, or, you know, I'm judging them or something like that. Because especially, I believe, our younger generations are so sensitive and, you know, have gone through COVID, you know, in formative years. And so there is so much shame and there is so much sadness and feeling the need of recognition that I'm currently focusing a lot of my life on how to be a better communicator, how to work with people who might see me as threatening, either to their ideologies and beliefs, or because I'm male, or because of any of these other sort of perceived attributes or power dynamics, because I know how important it is to be able to connect with a diverse group of people. One of the things we need the most is for Democrats and Republicans, BIPOC people and settler people, all of us, to be able to not entrench false identities that have been placed on us by a system that doesn't have our best interests at heart, you know, in order to understand our own uniqueness. And so I'm learning how to disarm some of these defense mechanisms, which are very strong right now in the world, as we see on a micro and macro level, you know, the trigger to slights, right? The ability for people to save face is so important. And I talk about this in my book. I talk about how we need to allow corporations to save face so that they don't double down on lying about harms or concealing harms that otherwise they could say, look, we did something really bad. We're really sorry. Please help us. Right? That's a mature thing to do, but it takes incredible bravery. It takes a framework that's not going to be punitive. Right? If we want to encourage trust and honesty so that we can be precautionary and catch things sooner, we need to create ecologies of discourse, which reward that sort of frankness, that sort of openness, that sort of vulnerability.
Which would be so different from our current litigation political system.
Yeah. But it's different, but I don't believe that it's impossible, because this is something that companies deeply want. Mm. They deeply want indemnity if they're able to, you know, come out ahead of the curve and say, oops, we need to recall this thing, instead of being forced 10 years after the fact, accumulated evidence, collateral damage of hundreds of thousands of lives, to fess up. And then even so, not fess up legally. They do a settlement agreements so that they never said they were guilty. They never admitted culpability. Instead, they just gave a shit ton of money. You know, this is not helping anybody. And so I do believe that the goodwill is there on all parts to adopt a different system. I just think that it's, in a sense, so radical, so, like I said, vulnerable, that we do need to do collectively at every level of society a lot of soul searching. And then we need some adult in the room to say, hey, I have an idea. Why don't we, you know, work with regulators, work with companies, work with those who are negatively affected and find good solutions so that we can have early warning systems and reward, you know, honesty and admitting mistakes. In the university setting, we say we want to allow students in problem-based learning to be able to make mistakes. In startup culture, you say fail faster. But in corporate world, where we're producing millions of pounds of chemicals that are, you know, killing us and the planet, there's no mechanism where people can say, oops, please forgive us. We need to like do something about this. Please help us. We don't know how. You know, what would that mean? That would mean complete and utter destruction for these companies and for not just them, but the entire industries that they're part of, you know, stock shareholders. You know, the whole thing is so fragile, so fragile. And it needs to become more robust. That's why I love systems theory, right? We talk about slack and redundancy and flexibility and diversity, right? So when you have other ways of meeting needs, then we would have more of a market system. But right now, we don't have any of the things that any of the people are saying that we actually have as our economic or political system. You know, we're basically just using empty words at this point. And as a semiotician, I take umbrage with that.
And we've come back now, Yogi, thank you so much, to the issue you raised at the beginning, that is of how we foster collective action. And I think what you're pointing to is the need for multifaceted responses, that we are caught in a matrix, to come back to one of your early words, a dysfunctional matrix of dysfunctional economic and social reinforces and status. I mean, in so many ways, our current systems are not serving the enormous needs and the growing threats we face. And so we come back to this question you raised early on, and maybe it's not a question, maybe it's more like a koan. I think of a koan being a Zen question, which doesn't have a final answer, but every time you ask it, it has the potential for taking you deeper into the question, deeper into yourself, and deeper into life. So I think you're leaving us with one of the great cons of our time, and I'm so grateful that you're doing the work you are, because it is so much needed, and unfortunately maybe even more needed. Yogi, as we come towards the end of our time, is there anything you would like to add?
Can I hold up the mirror, Yogi, just for one thing? You've been talking about a lot of really difficult, painful things, but I felt deep compassion coming through your teaching and your speaking, and that must be a yoga for you also, when you teach and you write and you speak, because I can definitely feel great compassion and wisdom and taking the perspectives of everyone and when you're looking at these different problems with a great deal of wisdom, a great deal of compassion. And I was very touched by that. So I just wanted to put that in there.
Thank you so much, John. And when I was being hired for my position in Rotterdam, they looked at my CV and all of my publications on, you know, huge transnational industries, and they say, so it looks like you hate corporations. And I said, I love justice more than I hate corporations. I'm not against anybody or anything. I'm going to always root for solutions that work for everybody, because I understand that the moment we start this us-them demonization thing for individuals, you know, for people, that we've already lost the battle, right?
Beautiful.
Because we can look at dysfunctional systems, but all human beings, you know, have a fundamental capacity for change and growth and evolution and, you know, divinity. One of my teachers, Starhawk, she says in her book, The Fifth Sacred Thing, she says, you can even say to your enemies, there's a place for you at our table if you're willing to join us. You're willing to put down your bombs and arms, put down your desire to kill us because you're so afraid. If you're willing to put that down and come have a meal for us. There's a place set for you at our table if you're willing to come join us at this table for everyone.
Beautiful.
I'm on team human. Good. Team more than human.
I like that. Haven't heard that before. Team more than human. May it be so. Yogi, this has been a wonderful gift you've given us today, and it's a gift you're giving us with your life and your work. It's so needed, and deep appreciation for everything you're doing, and thank you so much.
Thank you all for your beautiful reflections and your inquisitive nature and the connection that we've shared today. I really, really feel that even through the ethers.
Thank you very much for being a part of this conversation. We hope that you were moved as we are moved being part of it ourselves. We'd also like to say that this is being funded by Roger and myself. It comes out of our pockets. So if you would like to help us to mainly to get this podcast out to more people, because the bigger audience have, which is steadily growing, but the more people we can reach and the more marketing we can do, the more positive effect we can have on the world. So we've done a couple of ways, but we'd like you to buy us a cup of coffee. Very simple. And I do that with podcasts that I support, and I find it's very satisfying. So thank you for your help. Thank you for your presence, and thank you for all you are and all you do. We love you.